Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the future of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is now in the hands of a Trump-appointed federal judge to decide whether Leandra English, who was appointed acting director by outgoing director of the CFPB, Richard Cordray, is in charge, or Mick Mulvaney, who Trump has appointed as acting director. Kimberly Whaley, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and a former federal prosecutor, joins us to discuss her concern that Trump is constitutionally out of line and in creating this showdown between two branches of government, a major battle over the separation of powers is shaping up. And if Mulvaney is allowed to be seated by the judge as the head of the CFPB, it would give the president new powers to pick and choose which federal law Trump wants to comply with. Then we'll look into Trump's latest attack on CNN, calling CNN International fake news, and what consequences this could have for foreign correspondents abroad covering the news in countries run by despots and criminals who are now calling criticism of their corrupt and brutal regimes fake news. Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society, joins us to discuss Trump's tweet that Fox News, quote, is much more important in the United States than CNN, which he claims represents our country to the world very poorly. Then finally, we'll speak with David Neiwirth, an award-winning journalist, author, and expert on American right-wing extremism, about his new book, Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. He joins us to discuss accusations against the New York Times for normalizing a suburban neo-Nazi they profiled and whether the issue is not so much right-wing extremists centering the mainstream as America itself being in the process of mainstreaming extremism. And joining us now is Kimberly Whaley, who is an author, lawyer, and professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, a former assistant United States attorney. She was the associate independent counsel in the Whitewater investigation, and she is the author of the forthcoming book, The Outsourced Constitution, How Public Power in Private Hands Erodes Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kimberly Whaley.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. And just to sort of go through this dispute or this standoff between two acting heads of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, on Sunday night, the person appointed by the outgoing director, Ms. English, she asked the court to provide an emergency restraining order to block Mr. Trump's appointment of Mick Mulvaney. But then Tuesday, Judge Timothy Kelly of the Federal District Court in Washington said that Mick Mulvaney, Trump's pick, and the current director of the White House Office of Management and Budget could lead the Bureau. But that's not the end of it, is it?
No, actually, I've been trying to get a hold of the decision, but I haven't been unable to. But basically, his ruling was on a temporary restraining order, which is extreme relief. So essentially, what he did was leave the status quo in place, which would be, I guess, the president's pick at this point. Like I said, I haven't read the decision to determine whether he made any rulings specifically on which party should be the one that's actually presiding over the Bureau. He did, my understanding is, say that there are deep separation of powers issues here, and in that regard, I think he was spot on.
So will this then go to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit and possibly the Supreme Court?
Yeah, my understanding, I mean, that really depends on whether Ms. English's counsel decides to do it. The next step would be to actually go through a regular civil proceeding. That is not a temporary emergency order, but one where you actually brief everything very thoroughly and get a decision on whether there should be a permanent injunction, meaning a permanent ban on Mr. Mulvaney being at the Bureau. And based on that decision, it would go potentially to the D.C. Circuit and then up to the Supreme Court. But that, of course, depends on the appetite for Ms. English to push this and, the belief that this has sufficiently broader implications to continue the fight.
Well, she's not alone, though, is she? Barney Frank and others have also joined her. And my understanding is that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was set up in such a way that it was independent of the executive branch. And also, it was not funded through Congress. It was funded through the Federal Reserve. So aren't there some bigger issues at stake here?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are a number of big issues at stake. One is, as you mentioned, there's a long history of independent agencies starting in the early 30s where Congress decided, I mean, Congress creates federal agencies, and Congress decided, listen, we don't want these agencies politicized. We want them to be experts. So we're going to limit the ability of the president to fire them for any reason, to fire them at will. And the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, held that that's constitutional. So that is, there's a lot of precedent for that being just fine. The piece here that I think creates potential additional separation of powers conflict is that we have, I think, a pretty clear statute creating this Consumer Finance Protection, Financial Protection Bureau, in which Congress made pretty clear that in this context, when the director is unavailable, the assistant becomes the acting director. And that's probably for two reasons. I haven't read the legislative history yet, but one being that they wanted someone with experience in this area and not a political appointee. And second, because that would be someone that would have been chosen by the Senate-confirmed prior director. So it would, again, limit the president's ability to politicize the position. And what the president did here is kind of took a earlier statute relating to vacancies and said, you know what, I'm going to use this one instead and give myself the power. And I think that's problematic in potentially enhancing presidential power to allow a president to pick and choose which statute he believes binds him. I think it's not a Trump issue. That is something that just potentially aggrandizes the president's power for future generations.
Well, I understand that the executive branch is going to be arguing that the CFPB violates the unitary executive principle. In other words, Congress has insulated the agency too much from presidential control and budgets and procedures, etc. And in doing so, that violates the separation of powers. That seems like an odd argument. Do you think that will fly?
I don't, because a similar argument was made in the wake of the financial meltdowns involving Enron, and the agency, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, was created. And that very argument was made that, you know, this is an individual budget, one that is not tied to Congress, one that's based on fees that the agency charges, makes the agency too insulated from the president. The court actually did find that statute constitutional, but not because of that reason, not because they're independently funded. In that instance, the appointment and removal power was given completely to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the Supreme Court said, listen, that just cuts the president totally out of the picture. Here, I mean, President Trump can appoint a replacement for Mr. Cordray. It's just that person's going to have to be confirmed by the Senate. So in having somebody that he picks in an interim basis in that position, arguably is an end run around the confirmation process, and that's in place for a reason.
Well, that does seem to be the case. We're talking about next July that confirmation would be taking place. And also the judge, by the way, Judge Kelly, who's a Trump appointee, just recently appointed in September, I think he was an aide to Senator Grassley. He did ask the questions about how can Mick Mulvaney wear two hats. That wasn't answered, right?
That, again, I haven't had a chance to read the decision, I've done some research on it, and I think there are at least some legal experts that believe that in and of itself is not illegal. It might be imprudent, but I can't personally weigh in on that. I think that perhaps the bigger problem is that Mr. Mulvaney is on record as reportedly calling the CFPB a sick, sad joke. And so to the extent to which we're bypassing the process for having Congress confirm someone that's going to lead it in a manner that's consistent with the congressional intent, that's troubling, right? Because the CFPB is, as a constitutional matter, created by Congress for the purpose, in this instance, of protecting consumers. And so the public could suffer, individual consumers that have gripes against predatory lenders, banks, credit card companies. That's the jurisdiction of this agency. I mean, it's pretty user-friendly. You can just file a complaint online. And I might have mentioned $11.7 billion to date in 6 years since its inception have been given back to individual consumers. So it matters who heads this agency. And Congress set it up so that the president doesn't get to pick in the event of the actual director being unavailable. And as I can get into more detail, but I think the argument that this older statute, the Vacancies Reform Act, that controls, that's kind of problematic too, because that was actually passed in the wake of President Clinton using the interim director type position too much. Congress said, wait a minute, you can't just keep putting acting people in here and bypass the process. So we're going to pass a statute that makes the president actually put us in the loop. And so to actually allow this maneuver and on the theory that, well, the president has the power under the Vacancies Reform Act seems a little odd given the reasons for the Vacancies Reform Act, which is, listen, Congress has its constitutional prerogative for to actually confirm these people. And, you know, if you can't get them confirmed, pick someone else. But it's not, you know, up to the president to step in and just say, well, I don't really like this language, or I don't think it's the best reading of this other language kind of covers me. So I'm going to put in somebody who politically is consistent with my position. And this isn't a Republican versus a Democrat thing. I mean, I'm a law professor, and so I'm looking, you know, down the line, generation after generation. And once something's in the president's toolbox, or Congress's for that matter, it's kind of hard to dislodge it. So it's really important that every branch retain its powers so that individual liberties ultimately are protected. That's what the framers really cared about, making sure that the individual maintains its liberties and no one branch gets so powerful that they can boss everybody around and bully everyone, because then it's the individual people, the voters, that lose.
Well, what's at stake here is that the president, you know, nobody says that he can't appoint somebody, but he doesn't have the right to take over an independent agency without the advice and consent of the Senate, right? That's the precedent that worries you, right?
Correct. I mean, that is definitely the precedent. The other piece of it is kind of not really giving respect to clear language of Congress, because Congress passes statutes all the time. The president's job is to enforce them. And if what Congress does is sort of optional, that is also, I think, a problem constitutionally. So it's just the confirmation process for sure. That's number one. But number two is also this idea that if you've got clear language of a statute, we'll do some legal gymnastics, some very clever, I think, legal gymnastics to get around that. And they have a colorable argument. Obviously, they persuaded a federal district judge, so I don't want to suggest that it's an unethical, unlawful argument. But the easier path would have been just apply the language of the statute, let Ms. English carry out this vacancy. President Trump gets to make the choice as to who replaces Mr. Cordray, and we're not in this drama. We're not in court. We don't have a power struggle as to who's in charge. We're not talking about, you know, bringing donuts and all the other things that we're talking about now. And the work of government goes forward. I mean, to me, this was just a completely unnecessary legal maneuver that just hurts the populace. It hurts people who benefit from this agency working smoothly, because a major monkey wrench has been thrown in there that really wasn't necessary. You just apply the language of the CFPB Act and we're done.
Right, but what people are worried about is that this is, again, and this is not the first time in this administration, putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, putting the Wrecking Crew in there. I mean, the thing that I find extraordinary is what could be wrong with an agency that has returned about $12 billion to about 30 million Americans? What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, it's wrong if you're concerned about the parties that are actually returning the dollars, that is, you know, big banks and credit card companies and lenders. That they certainly don't like that. And there have been efforts in since the Republicans took over both houses of Congress to amend the Dodd-Frank Act that created the CFPB to give the president more power, and it hasn't passed. It passed in the House, but not in the Senate. So.
And they held up Cordray, by the way, for what, a year or two, didn't they?
That sounds right.
Yeah.
So this is clearly a kind of a David and Goliath battle, one between, you know, big moneyed interests that make a lot of donations to political campaigns, presumably, and protecting, you know, people from being ripped off, right? when we have, you know, when we have some one particular bill from Verizon, for example, or one of our service providers, where there's an error on it or something fundamental and $2-3, you know, we might not have the time or the effort, or there's certainly the money to hire a lawyer to fix that, right? So it does matter if you can get government to walk in and say, listen, we see you're doing X to millions or thousands or millions of people. You need to stop it because it's starting to add up, and we're not going to let you take advantage of the system this way. And I think that's at least the theory behind the CFPB. But we all know that's also Elizabeth Warren's brainchild, and I don't think she and Trump have a lot of things in common at this point.
Well, Kimberly Whaley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you. And again, I was speaking with Kimberly Whaley, who's an author, lawyer, and professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, a former assistant United States attorney and associate independent counsel in the Whitewater investigation. She is the author of the forthcoming book, The Outsourced Constitution, How Public Power in Private Hands Erodes Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump's latest attacks on CNN expose foreign correspondents to even more danger.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call jewels to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. Where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dudes, don't let them play us. Girls, they are.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Dan Cassino, is a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as the director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Cassino.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you, Dan. And it does seem to me that in many ways, the twins, if you will, running America as much as the president does, and this particular president seems woefully out of his depth and sort of governs by stunt and by PR stunts. But the one person who he talks to every day, who, if he doesn't direct the agenda, he certainly is the echo chamber for Trump's support and keeps Trump's base in the bubble, is Rupert Murdoch. And here's Trump on Saturday tweeting out an attack on CNN and then, of course, praising Fox. You know, Fox News is much more important in the United States than CNN, but outside of the U.S., CNN International is still a major source of fake news, and they represent our nation to the world very poorly. If you're a foreign correspondent working for CNN, or any foreign correspondent, frankly, in these rough countries run by despots and gangsters, etc., and kleptocrats, where your situation is pretty insecure to begin with, and you're usually covering a war or civil war. That, and by the way, this all happened on the very day that Putin rolled back access to the Western press in Russia. So normally a president would go out on an occasion like that and make a statement condemning Putin's action and reinforcing America's values, and particularly in terms of the First Amendment. So I found this whole thing that happened on Saturday absolutely shocking and, of course, depressing as usual.
Well, it's also fairly dangerous. We've actually seen this rhetoric of fake news being taken up by undemocratic leaders around the world. So we've got Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, who was democratically elected by some measures. And so he talks a lot about fake news, and any news he doesn't like is now labeled as fake news. If the American president does it, it is a license for anyone around the world to do it as well. And that's really what's so dangerous about it. The president having a feud with domestic news stations, that's bad, and it's beneath the dignity of the office to great, but it's also domestic. Once this becomes international, it becomes a real problem for America, and as you pointed out, for American reporters. We should also know Trump was saying, boy, it's terrible that CNN is everywhere and Fox News is so much better. It's not as though Fox News hasn't tried to go outside of the United States. It's that it hasn't been popular. One of the reasons Fox News has been so popular in the United States is because it was really the first of the openly political news organizations to come in, basically importing the British tabloid model into the United States, and it was the first of its kind. In other countries, they already have something like that, so Fox News just hasn't been successful. It went off the air in the United Kingdom very recently, not because of any government censorship, just because no one was watching it. CNN is important because it is so wide-reaching. CNN International is trusted. It gets very good ratings in most countries around the world. It has lots of local editions in various countries around the world. And because it is an American company, it is linked with America, it has already come under attack from leaders who don't like what they're reporting. Now, you could argue that, you know, when Vladimir Putin goes ahead and puts restrictions on foreign press, on, let's say, the Voice of America, which is funded by the government and is doing, you know, by some measure, propaganda, it may make sense to put limitations on them. But he puts a limitation on CNN that is not only against the interest of CNN, it really is against our own national interest, which always in the past, at least, has been for more open and free exchange of ideas.
So you've written a book about Fox News, obviously, Dan Cascino, and studied it in depth. Do you think, though, that Donald Trump is an authoritarian, or is he just this creature of publicity and public relations, which he clearly is? He craves attention and most of all praise, and he treats the press, I think, as an extension of public relations. So is this a sinister side of him, or is he an unconscious authoritarian, or is he an active authoritarian?
I think he would very much like to be an authoritarian. I think he has authoritarian tendencies. I don't think he's doing a very good job of it as the issue. In terms of the press, this is actually going back to a much older version of the press. This is about the way Teddy Roosevelt, for instance, dealt with the press, where if you wrote positive things about him, you got access, you got interviews, you got exclusives. If you wrote negative things, you were shut out completely. So it's not unprecedented. What's different is how open he's being about it. Teddy Roosevelt didn't come out and say, your newspaper's bad, I'm not going to give interviews to other people, and come out and say that to the public, where Donald Trump is. It also goes against the norm of the sort of the relationship between the press and the president we've had for the past 50 years, and that's really what's so shocking. The press that we have today, the partisan press, isn't much different than we had in the 19th century, but it's very different than what we've had since really the start of the Cold War. And that's what makes this so shocking. And again, if this is purely domestic, you can put it off as, oh, this is the president's style. He's used to dealing with New York tabloids, which are similar to the British tabloids, and this is the way you run things when you're dealing with New York tabloids. You know, you side with the Daily News versus the Times. You know, there's ways to do this in New York. But when it gets international, you've got a real problem. And the scenes have been really kicked off by the president's trip overseas, where Fox News isn't an option when you're touring Asia. You basically have to be watching CNN, and he realized, boy, CNN is saying bad things about me. And we know from reports of his staff that they stop him, make sure he does not get any negative news about himself during his daily briefings, during his day-to-day life. So it must have come as a great shock to him to turn on the TV in Asia and find it's all negative news about him. And he has to vent about that somehow. It's shocking that we have a president who feels the need to do that, but given what we know about President Trump, it's not at all surprising.
And again, I'm speaking with Dan Cascino, who's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. So when you were saying earlier, Dan, that Fox has failed abroad because it is seen as propaganda, is that because in a lot of the countries you basically have state TV? And I've always thought of Fox as the kind of Pravda of the Republican Party, and now that Trump's in power, it's very much the Pravda of the Trump administration.
I think that's actually taking it a little bit too far, Ian, and here's why. Pravda is very much top-down. The government is saying to the newspapers or the state media, this is what we want you to print. Fox News is actually working the other direction. That is, Fox News, to some extent, is setting the agenda for the White House. the president watches Fox News, and what they say, they go, oh, that's the issue we have to deal with today. So Fox News is very much doing the agenda setting. And Fox News has a very different idea of what should happen than the president does, necessarily. So the president is much more about populism. Fox News' goal has always been to keep together, or at least for the past 10 years, to keep together the kind of radical, conservative, bomb-throwing Tea Party side of the Republican Party, together with the pro-business side, the Rockefeller Republicans used to call them, side of the Republican Party, and to keep those two bases together. And that's what they're trying to do, and that's not necessarily what Trump is trying to do. Trump doesn't really care too much about the pro-business side, and Fox News is very much actively herding him towards working with the Rockefeller Republicans on things that really are outside of what he would generally want to do.
Well, his remarks about CNN and praise of Fox and suggesting that it should be the voice of America abroad has prompted a couple of interesting characters to come out of the Woodworth and obviously very disturbed. James Comey came out and basically tweeted a quote from Jefferson praising and explaining the importance of the First Amendment. And the former head of the CIA and the National Security Agency, Michael Hayden, basically said this whole attack on CNN was an outrageous assault on the First Amendment, quoting Hayden. If this is who we are or who we are becoming, I have wasted 40 years of my life. Pretty strong statement, wouldn't you say?
Of course. And it is very much against what America has done for the past 50 or 60 years. And I think perhaps this is the most dangerous thing about Trump, is that he is breaking norms at such a rate that we don't have time to understand or accept how those norms are being broken. There was a period during the Obama administration where President Obama did not want to talk to Fox News. Actually, made a public statement against Fox News, said they didn't like him, he wasn't going to bother doing interviews with them, and he got a lot of heat for that. And in response, he actually did a couple interviews with Fox News to show, look, I'm going to treat everyone fairly, even if I think they're not treating me fairly. That was a furor that lasted days or weeks during the last administration. Now this is going to be something that dies out in a day or two when the next shocking, norm-breaking thing comes through. The real danger of Trump is that we lose track of what norms are important and what norms are not. And freedom of the press, an impartial press, is extremely important. But it's inconvenient for someone who doesn't like what the public is saying about him, and so he's working against them. We have to bear in mind which ones are important, which fights we have to deal with and which fights we don't. I would propose this is one of the fights we really have to worry about.
Right, but Dan, is he sort of operating government by stunt, by throwing out red meat, by being provocative? For example, yesterday when he met with the Navajo code breakers from World War II, wonderful veterans, did extraordinary, saved thousands of lives, and it was a sort of hallowed moment, albeit in front of the portrait of the great Indian killer, Andy Jackson. Nevertheless, it was an appalling thing that he did. He just suddenly, you know, in a very clumsy and ludicrous way, he took a shot at Senator Elizabeth Warren, calling her again Pocahontas, and it was so out of place. So my question would be, is he cynically throwing out these provocative acts on a daily basis to keep everybody off balance or be what Jeb Bush said, the chaos president? Or is he just simply out of control?
I don't like the arguments. I've certainly seen plays arguments that the president is playing five-dimensional chess. Like, he wants to create controversy because he wants to be on top of things. I don't believe he's doing it, because there are much more efficient ways you could do it if that's what he was trying to do. I would argue the president has a problem with impulsivity, that especially when he's speaking off the cuff, he says offensive things. And we take those offensive things seriously, as we should, because he is the president. And that sort of sensationalism that he creates dominates the news cycle. However, I don't think that's a good strategy. I actually had a conversation with former British Prime Minister David Cameron about this a couple weeks ago. What he said was, there's a temptation when you're in office to do the fight of the day and figure out the fight of the day and try and get ahead of that. And the problem with that is, if you're just doing the fight of the day every day, you never get to the big things, because that distracts you. That stops you from doing and dealing with the really big issues that you want to deal with, that you got into office to deal with. President Trump had a lot of things he got into office saying he wanted to do, and not all of them are ones that Democrats would necessarily be opposed to. Infrastructure spending, for instance. But the fact that he's fighting these fights every day, his administration is consumed with these individual little day-to-day fights. I mean, watch the White House press briefing. It is always about the scandal of the day that day. It's never about infrastructure week or tax week or whatever it's supposed to be. This detracts from the president's ability to actually do the things that he and his party might really want to do. I guarantee you Republicans in Congress would love for the president to just be quiet for a week or two so they could actually get some stuff done. The fact that he can't do that stops his party from really being effective in government. So it's not five-dimensional chess, it's impulsivity. And it's that lack of discipline that's haunted him throughout the campaign trail and now as president that is really stopping him from, as you say, becoming authoritarian, but at the very least from pursuing the policy goals that he might want to.
And does that mean that General Kelly has sort of basically failed to rein him in and take away his Twitter account?
Well, General Kelly's job was never to take away his Twitter account. General Kelly's job was to stop him from doing ill-advised things in government. I would say this is a sign that perhaps General Kelly is doing the right thing, that we are all talking about not some policy agenda, some ill-advised law that he's proposing, or some executive order that he shouldn't be doing. Rather, we're talking about what he said on Twitter. And I think for people within the government, that is a safer way for him to be operating. Politically, operating against the media within the Republican Party has been something that's been, you know, a well-worn idea, going back to Richard Nixon, that you play the ref, you attack the media. That's kind of a safe way to do it, because it distracts him from attacking Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell, which is what they really don't want to happen right now. So I'm not sure it means Kelly's failed. It means that the president is picking fights with people that it's not going to hurt things too much right now. But as we said, this potentially has very long-term consequences. Just as when the United States was found to be torturing people, that opened our soldiers up to torture, if we start siding against freedom of the press, it hurts freedom of the press everywhere and comes back to haunt us.
But could you make the case that Donald Trump has actually been successful in somehow distracting people, and particularly the press? For example, the tax bill that he's pushing through now, he met on the Hill about today, it's clearly designed to please the donors. And the challenge for the Republicans is to basically con their voters into believing this is going to be good for the middle class, when in fact it's good for the super rich. And the evidence is just overwhelming. This is a president who ran against Wall Street. You recall he painted Hillary Clinton as a tool of Wall Street. Is that an example of somebody that's either deeply cynical or extremely clever?
I don't think it's either. I would argue, honestly, much like Ronald Reagan in 1986 with the big tax reform plan of 1986, the president doesn't really know or care very much about the details of the tax plan. He knows there's a tax plan, he doesn't really know or care what the details of it are. If the president wanted to help the tax reform proposal, he would be going on CNN, he would be going on Fox News, he'd be going on morning shows and talking about why this tax plan is good. And even if he's lying, he would be going out and talking to the details and talking about provisions that he likes in the bill. So, for instance, they're increasing the child deduction, the standard deduction for children, which could help some people. Well, you can go on TV and talk about that. You can do local television in states where swing state senators are. In order, you know, states that the senators might swing, you do local television there to put pressure on them. There's a lot the president could be doing and a lot that other presidents in this position would be doing when trying to pass a major legislative agenda piece. The president isn't doing any of that. All we're hoping at this point, if you're a Republican, all you're hoping is the president doesn't do something to derail and hurt the bill. They're not even considering the president could do something to actually help the bill. And that's a huge problem. If the president was out pressuring senators, doing those sort of local TV interviews, pushing this bill, he could get this bill past the finish line much more easily. We're now seeing people giving this current bill about a 60-40 shot of passing the Senate. That's shocking that Republicans aren't able to pass a bill because they don't have a president who's able to organize things, because they have a president who's fighting about whether or not it's okay to call Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. Spoiler alert, it's not. But that's the fight we're having rather than talking about tax reform.
Well, just in closing, though, isn't it possible that he will have a string of significant victories, that the Republicans simply will vote for this thing because they don't want to look like they can't get anything done? And it's all analysis that I've seen that this tax bill is a catastrophe for the average American. Is it also possible that Roy Moore will be elected, a pedophile, to the United States Senate? That will be a victory for Trump as well. Maybe he'll win with Mulvaney, with the judge that he just appointed. So it's not as if he's not having victory. So does that mean that the press are failing, to somehow get the message across about what's really happening here? Whose failure is it that Trump is going to look like he will have some victories?
I would say, so first off, all of these things are momentary victories and strategic losses. Having Roy Moore win and having him join the Senate is a long-term loss for the Republican Party, because every Republican senator will at that point have to be asked, how do you feel about Roy Moore? And he's going to have to talk about this, and they don't want to do that. Passing a major bill that is currently in the polls with approval somewhere around 20%, meaning most Republicans don't even like this bill. You can pass that bill, but it is going to hurt you even more when it comes to re-election day. So these are momentary victories and strategic losses. So who is failing if these victories get through? The fact that these things are unpopular means the press is doing its job. The public knows that Donald Trump and this Republican bill is not good for them. You only see that reflected in the polling data. Now, whether that's true or not, that's certainly what the public believes according to the polls. So the public is somewhat informed on this. You can say, well, maybe it should be lower. But the real problem here is that the linkage between the public and the Congress has been severed. The Congress doesn't necessarily care if something is popular or unpopular in the public. It matters on the margins. We did see some Republicans in the House vote against this bill. But it doesn't matter for the leadership, who, as you noted, is much more concerned about donors who are going to be funding the re-election bid next year. What's failed here is the system. I don't think any individual actor necessarily has gone wrong.
Well, curiously, Dan, I'm a little encouraged by what you've told me. I've been very depressed about it. So I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dan Cassino, who's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as the director of the experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the mainstreaming of extremism in Trump's America.
When the Fuhrer says, "We is the master race," we heil, heil, right in the Fuhrer's face. Not to love the Fuhrer is a great disgrace. So we heil, heil, right in the Fuhrer's face. When her Goebbels says, "We own the world in space," we heil, heil, right in her Goebbels face. When her Goering says, "They'll never bomb this."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Nywert, who's an award-winning journalist, author, and expert on American right-wing extremism. His books include The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, Strawberry Days, How Internment Destroyed a Japanese-American Community, as well as And Hell Followed With Her, Crossing the Dark Side of the American Border. His latest book just out is Alt-America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Nywert.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And, of course, the rise of the radical right is a global phenomenon, and there were recent demonstrations, of course, in Poland that were quite shocking. Of all places, a country that where the worst Nazi atrocities were committed, young Poles are walking down the main street in Warsaw, saying Sieg Heil and pure blood and white Europe and all of this stuff. So clearly there's something happening in the global sense. But my concern is that the neo-Nazis in this country, the alt-right, are starting to look more like bankers and accountants than skinheads and tattooed thugs. And interesting enough, the New York Times got slammed for its what people accused of being a sympathetic profile of a suburban neo-Nazi. So has there been a kind of morphing, if you will, of the Nazis in this country into the mainstream?
Well, yes, although honestly, some of it has to do with morphing of the mainstream into Nazis. I mean, honestly, that's a lot of the dynamic that's been going on, is that mainstream conservatism has been increasingly radicalized over the last 10 years, 10, 15 years. And, you know, as you know, Ian, I've been writing about this consistently for some time, that, you know, mainstream conservatism is becoming more and more radical and more radicalized. And that's how we've gotten to this point, to the point. I mean, now Patrick Buchanan's overt white nationalism, that he was, you know, made him a persona non grata back in 2001 and 2, is now very much mainstream, and he's become fully rehabilitated as, you know, our avuncular old conservative white guy. And, you know, that's really fairly typical of what I think is the dynamic at play here. Yeah, and that's maybe the part that's missing from the discussion of the piece on the New York Times. I mean, it really was a fairly atrocious piece of journalism that normalized Nazis in a way that I hadn't seen for quite some time. And it just had to do with the fact that the reporter was really inexperienced in actually having to deal with these guys. Now, you know, and I've been dealing with them actually since the late 1970s, so I know all the pitfalls, and it was kind of an agonizing piece to read.
Well, it's been agonizing in general to have the President of the United States basically make excuses for the Nazis in Charlottesville and equate them with the people they were beating up, including a young woman that was killed.
Sure.
That was just beyond belief. And now he's supporting a pedophile for the United States Senate.
Sure.
I mean, how much lower can the bar go? I mean,
they're getting started. They're just getting started. Trust me on this. Ian, what the dynamic that's at work is that these people are authoritarians. They're right-wing authoritarians, and boy, once you start going down that path, you know, the end of the line is, you know, concentration camps and gas chambers. That's where this all goes. And so that's the road this takes us down. So Americans need to wake up to that reality, that, you know, we're being, their democratic institutions that they thought were going to just be stable for forever are under attack. These are profoundly anti-democratic movements. The alt-right is profoundly anti-democratic. So is the Patriot Militia movement. They're all fundamentally authoritarian, and they want to replace, you know, democracy with an authoritarian state. That's their goal. So, you know, they're openly antipathetic to democratic institutions and democratic principles. They like to use them to their own advantage, such as free speech, that you are intimately familiar with what's been happening in terms of how they use the issue of free speech to basically propagandize on their own behalf. It's a very cynical use of the principle. And, you know, it's just been ongoing since the election. And, you know, Donald Trump isn't just making excuses for them. It's really important for people to understand that the people on the radical right see him as their leader. He is their inspiration. It is under his banner that all of these factions have come together and rallied as one in a way we haven't seen in the United States in any time in its history.
Well, frankly, my sense is that, you know, talk about the New York Times normalizing a Nazi. Don't you think the term alt-right itself kind of normalized people like Stephen Bannon? It's an innocuous term compared to who these people really are.
Well, it is. It's part of the problem that we've always had in dealing with these guys. Look, we kind of had the same problem back in the 1990s when the militia movement started popping up, and they called themselves the Patriot Movement. And trust me, you never met a more seditious bunch of people in your life than these guys. They're pretty much the antithesis of what you would normally think of as patriotic. But yet that's pretty much what we've kind of had to call them. And what the key is just understanding the sort of elasticity of language, and understanding that what matters is the perception of the name rather than what it may be intended originally as a PR term. But I think a lot of us have been working very hard to make people understand that alt-right equals fascist or proto-fascist. It's fundamentally a proto-fascist movement. I think if it doesn't, in the end, what you call them, you know, look, there's also an accuracy issue that I have to deal with. People say, well, why don't you just call them Nazis? Well, for me, as someone who works with reporting on this stuff, Nazis occupy a very specific bandwidth of behavior and agendas and ideology. And these guys don't fit into, Nazis fit within the larger alt-right bandwidth, but it's a much broader and much more complex movement than that. And so just to call them Nazis doesn't actually catch the essence of them, and particularly the really powerful misogynist element that is there in the alt-right that's arisen out of the video gaming community, but also other aspects of it as well, including their hatred of mainstream conservatism, as well as, you know, there are just other aspects of it that Nazi doesn't capture, and alt-right is the only term that we've got that actually kind of covers the bandwidth. And so I don't mind calling them the alt-right, if so long as everybody understands that alt-right is fundamentally proto-fascist. And that's, to me, the bigger task, is changing everyone, getting everyone to understand what alt-right means.
Well, preceding you on today's program, David and I were talking about Trump's recent tweets attacking CNN International and saying they propagate fake news around the world and recommending that Fox News becomes the voice of America abroad. And my sense is that, first of all, you know, obviously that puts correspondents in danger in these authoritarian countries where so much of the news happens, some of them quite lawless. And then it leads me to, when you talk about Trump being the leader of these people, Spencer and all those people see Trump as their leader. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
But the glue, as far as I can tell, is Rupert Murdoch and Fox. Isn't that what corrals all these people in this bubble of delusion where they believe everything that Trump says and everything that the rest of the media says is fake news?
Well, it's not just Murdoch, but there is no question that Fox News and Murdoch's operations have been the largest players in creating this epistemological bubble that I call Alt-America, this alternative universe for themselves that they've built around themselves. And there's no question that Fox News, throughout the Bush years, really throughout the Clinton years, into the Bush years, and especially during the Obama years, really created this huge divide between people who live in reality. You know, as Colbert says, reality has a well-established liberal bias, and you know, that's how they've behaved. That any kind of, you know, they basically have preferred to go with falsehoods and distortions as their version of reality, because otherwise they might have to deal with the reality that sometimes liberals are right. But at any rate, so Murdoch and Fox News have been the role that they've played is that they've made it happen on a massive level. And especially, you know, early in the Obama years when they had Glenn Beck on the air, they became profoundly conspiracist in their orientation and running a lot of conspiracy theories. But when it comes to conspiracism, there's no question that the other gorilla on the block is Alex Jones and InfoWars, which has a massive audience. And they're the ones sort of out there on the edge who are drawing everybody further and further out into this alternative universe that fundamentally is just crazy.
Well, but Trump tweets out to these people. He's praised Alex Jones and this other, what they call something pill, complete whack jobs.
The MAGA pill.
MAGA pill, yeah. And he said they're the real news because they say nice things about him. Is Trump really a fascist, or does he really just only understand the media in terms of public relations, because that's all he's been doing over the years, is manipulating the media and getting himself in the headlines?
Well, he's actually, so he's not a fascist in the classic sense, and this is actually really important, understanding what is going on, because honestly, a real fascist wouldn't have been as successful as Trump has been. That's why it's so important that he's not. But yet, what he is a classic right-wing populist demagogue. And everybody has sort of this misunderstanding of what constitutes fascism. Fascism is not, as a lot of people, both on the left and right, seem to believe, that fake quote from Mussolini that fascism is the marriage of corporatism and the government, and government power. That's a fake quote. He never actually said that, and that's not what fascism is. Fascism, nor is fascism Jonah Goldberg and the author of Liberal Fascism and Dinesh D'Souza, who wrote another book claiming that liberals were the real fascists. Neither is that accurate, even remotely at all. What fascism really ultimately is right-wing populism gone metastatic, gone wildly out of control, and becoming power mad, power hungry, and seeks power for its own sake. And that's what right-wing populism often, when it's unleashed, can turn into. And so Trump is very much playing on right-wing populism, and particularly its authoritarian component. And in that sense, he's doing it very much in the style of Henry Ford, who you may recall actually was the person who first promoted the hoax of Protocols of the Seven Elders of Zion, which Hitler then seized upon. He gave an Iron Cross to Henry Ford at one time for his service in this regard. And there's this powerful connection between right-wing populism and fascism, and we're really seeing that dynamic play out in the United States now.
But isn't it always or mostly sort of inextricably bound with racism? I go back to Roy Moore, for example, because I'm just so appalled at the idea that that guy can get elected to the United States Senate, and he just, you know, all that sort of piety that he dresses himself up with. This is a very sick man, obviously. But the other day, when he actually first emerged after the first of the women came forth in the Washington Post story, he spoke at a church and dismissed it all as, you know, a Democratic hit job. And let's talk about the real issues. The first one is that in 1963, the Supreme Court outlawed prayer in school, issue number one. Issue number two, in 1965, they gave away special rights. Well, that is the Voting Rights Act. If that's not racist to the bone, I don't know what is.
That's right.
You know, and Charles Barkley has been down there campaigning for the Democrat, basically saying, you know, this is Stephen Bannon's, you know, white supremacist candidate.
Yeah, yeah. No, and that's absolutely right. And, of course, this is when we're looking at more. We're looking at the Christian evangelical component of Trump's base. And there's no question that, in my mind at least, conservative evangelicals, right-wing evangelicals, are fundamentally, they're religious authoritarians. It's authoritarianism applied to the religious realm. And so naturally it fits in very neatly with people who are the personality types that are attracted to that kind of religion are also very much political authoritarians, right-wing authoritarians. And so they really mesh together very neatly, and it's not a surprise that they are part of that. And Moore's comments kind of underscore one of the realities that a lot of us who studied this for a long time understand, which is that when after the civil rights era in the mid-60s, you've got to remember that the Christian right, the evangelical right, was really closely tied up with the civil rights fight. And they were on the side of the segregationists and on the side of people who opposed civil rights advances for minorities. And after that, it became clear that that fight was lost. They changed their focus beginning in the mid-70s, early 70s, from civil rights and racial issues to abortion. But regardless of what the issue was, the underlying issue for them really was always going to be about race. And they just used abortion as kind of a proxy for attacking liberals and for recruiting within their own ranks and proselytizing. So, you know, when you hear them talking about abortion, a lot of times what they're really upset about is race.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think that the right wing's bugaboo enemy du jour is this, what they call Islamofascists? They've sort of, you know, there's still a bit some anti-Semitism out there, but now they're going after the Muslims. Is it then appropriate to refer to these hypocrites, as a listener wrote into me, as Christo-fascists?
Well, I don't know about Christo-fascists. Certainly Christianists would be perfectly fine with me because, you know, I deal with terrorism quite a bit, and there is Islamist terrorism, and what, as opposed to, I don't use the word Islamic because it suggests that the entire religion is inclined to that kind of radicalism. But the Islamists are people who want to create a religious theocratic state under Islam. And as far as I'm concerned, the Christianists are people who want to create a Christian theocratic state under Christianity. And they are perfectly, almost exact, perfect mirrors of each other, except that the Islamists are in poorer economic straits and thus more inclined to acting out with, you know, terrorist violence in their world. But the Christianists are not very far behind in that regard.
Well, David Nywert, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate you having me on, Ian. Give me a call anytime.
Absolutely. And again, I've been speaking with David Nywert, who's an award-winning journalist, author, and expert on American right-wing extremism. His books include The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, Strawberry Days, How Internment Destroyed a Japanese-American Community, and Hell Followed With Her, Crossing the Dark Side of the American Border. And his latest book just out is Alt-America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.